This is VOA News. I'm Joe Palca. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is traveling Wednesday to Riyadh to discuss with Saudi officials the attack on Saudi Arabian oil facilities that U.S. officials say they believe originated from Iran. Iran-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen have claimed responsibility for Saturday's attack, which knocked out half of Saudi Arabia's oil production. But U.S. officials say the available evidence is showing that is not possible. Saudi Minister of State for Foreign Affairs Adel Al-Jubeir.
The more engagement you have with Iran, the more Iran believes that its aggressive behavior is acceptable in the world, and that's not acceptable. So those issues have to be reconsidered.
The minister said on Saturday that the kingdom would build its response to last weekend's attacks on the country's largest oil processing facility based on the results of the investigation.
We are in consultations with our allies and friends with regards to the next steps that we need to take. We are awaiting the final results of the investigation with regards to the attack, and in particular where it originated from, so that we can build a response on that.
The Pentagon said the U.S. will deploy additional troops and military equipment to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to beef up security. According to a person familiar with the matter, President Trump urged the new leader of Ukraine this summer to investigate the son of former Vice President Joe Biden. Democrats condemned what they saw as a clear effort to damage a political rival. Trump defended himself Friday against the intelligence official's complaint.
It's a partisan whistleblower. They shouldn't even have information. I've had conversations with many leaders. They're always appropriate.
Although Mr. Trump characterized the whistleblower as partisan, he also said he did not know who that whistleblower was. This is VOA News. Swedish teenage activist Greta Thunberg on Saturday told a UN youth summit about the success of the youth protests that took place around the world on Friday.
Millions of people across the globe marched and demanded real climate action, especially young people. We showed that we are united and that we young people are unstoppable.
With world leaders about to gather in New York for a UN Climate Action Summit next week, a youth panel addressed the assembly on Saturday to demand urgent measures to stop environmental catastrophe. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
But first of all, it's an enormous pleasure to be a keynote listener when we can listen to meaningful things like the ones we heard. And indeed, I've been more times keynote speaker than keynote listener, but that is one of the problems of world leaders, is that they talk too much and they listen too little.
He encouraged young activists to continue to hold leaders accountable. Thousands of people in Hong Kong have taken to the streets of the Chinese territory for the latest round of pro-democracy demonstrations. Reuters reports police fired tear gas on demonstrators who vandalized a light rail station. The protesters began their rally on Saturday after pro-China supporters tore down some of the city's dozens of Lenin walls that were created with colorful post-it notes on which anti-government messages have been written. The walls are named after the 1980 John Lennon Wall in communist-controlled Prague that was splattered with Beatles lyrics and messages of political outrage. A proposed bill that would have allowed some Hong Kong criminal suspects to be extradited to mainland China for trial sparked the month-long anti-government demonstrations, and that proposal has already been withdrawn. And France can also be thrown in the protest mix as protesters in the French capital are trying to revive the anti-government yellow vest movement, and in doing so were met with tear gas from police on Saturday. Paris is under high security with thousands of police and riot gear stationed at the city landmarks, including the Champs-Élysées, the Eiffel Tower, and Notre-Dame Cathedral. The Associated Press reports at least 39 people have been arrested. Demonstrators wearing vests began taking to French streets around the country, but especially Paris, about 10 months ago. For more on all these stories, visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Joe Palca, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
We know the time frame. We know that immediately after the nominations for the candidates for the National Assembly and the local government, which is going to follow the presidential ones on the 26th of September, we know that now you have to go out and print ballot papers.
A Botswana High Court will begin processing nomination papers for presidential candidates Saturday.
Well, for us in opposition, that Kaiwara is now one person, and the IGP who was so bad on us, let him face it. Then the rest can be handled later. He was in the forefront, whether he was doing his own work or he was doing the team work.
A Ugandan parliamentarian calls for the arrest and prosecution of former police chief General Kale Kaihura.
The old news is on the Supreme Court. Like when we release the classified document showing the move to the order to freeze the accounts of the former CJ. Security people ask us, how did we get it? Because there are some Nigerians who are in that judiciary who are not happy with the way things are going.
And a major Nigerian opposition party expresses concern about an alleged plan to manipulate the Supreme Court. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A spokesperson for the Botswana Independent Electoral Commission says the High Court will begin processing nomination papers for presidential candidates for the election Saturday. Osupele Maroba says electoral laws prevent independent candidates from filing as presidential contestants. The Constitution stipulates that nominations for president must be carried out within 20 days of the dissolution of Parliament. For more about preparations for the upcoming elections, I reach Osupele Maroba, spokesperson for the Botswana Independent Electoral Commission.
All the political parties would be submitting their preferred candidate who would assume the presidency of the country in case their political parties win 29 plus seats in the National Assembly.
So what has been the response of the Electoral Commission so far in terms of preparation for the upcoming elections next month?
We are on top of issues, sir. Since we are guided by the law, it is very easy to make sure that each and every phase is adequately prepared for, because we know the time frame. We know that immediately after the nominations of the for the candidates for the National Assembly and the local government, which is going to follow the presidential ones on the 26th of September, we know that now you have to go out and print ballot papers. Now, we have also agreed with the supplier, the printer of the ballot papers. We have given the printer the time frame so that we are able to meet all the requirements of the law as we prepare for elections. So everything is on track.
Which organization is printing the ballot papers, and will they be printed in the country? And will these political parties be part of the process to ensure transparency?
The printer of ballot papers is not done in Botswana. We don't have any company that has the capacity to print ballot papers. We are printing ballot papers in South Africa, a reputable company that has printed ballot papers for other African countries. I'm not able to give you the name of the company at the moment, but it's a company that has printed ballot papers for other countries, so it's a reputable company. Now, political parties, if they so wish, they are in the liberty to send people to go and witness the print of ballot papers, but at their own cost, not covered by the Independent Electoral Commission.
For those political parties who are in negotiations to form an alliance, what deadline do they have to meet in order to present a single candidate for the election, presidential election-wise?
If they haven't agreed now, as I'm speaking to you, then they must move with speed, because the Electoral Commission would expect any candidate who stands for a National Assembly to have an endorsing letter from the president or the leader of that particular movement to say, I allow this person to stand on the symbol of this alliance or the symbol of this party. Now, I'm saying they should move with speed because they should be, by the 26th of September, they should have submitted their symbols, assessed and approved by the Electoral Commission, and having everything in place as that when we require them to submit the letter to the leader of that movement, they should be able to do so. If they can do that in the remaining 2 weeks, fair and fair, they will be able to put their nominated candidate under the decided collaboration. But if they can't, then we expect that what is existing today would only be the situation that will prevail. Remember, we have one group that we know that they have submitted their symbol, and they have said that all the people who are part of the pact will be contesting under the symbol and the color of that particular party. So we expect that the leader of that pact to be writing letters to those that they have agreed to field under them to show that they allow them to use their symbols and color in these elections.
And for the first time, the president has said that there will be 3 days of holidays to allow people to go and vote, since elections will be held for the first time during the week. Talk to me about this, and how significant is this for Motswanis to go and vote?
Our general elections have been slated for a Wednesday, which would mean that Wednesday would be a paid holiday because it would be a polling day. Now, our counting of votes, which is manual, takes almost 1.5 days. It would mean that the whole of Wednesday will be voting day. At the end of the day, at 7 p.m. in the evening on Wednesday, poll closes, verification of ballot papers takes place, which ends around midnight, and then Thursday, the whole day will be involved in counting the votes, which sometimes take us to up to maybe Friday noon.
Osupile Maroba is the spokesperson for the Botswana Independent Electoral Commission. He spoke with me from the capital, Habaroni. The leader of the opposition in the Ugandan parliament says the U.S. government should have arrested and jailed General Kaile Kaihura, the former inspector general of police over human rights violations. Betty Alo-Chan says the former police chief supervised violence unleashed on opponents of President Yoweri Museveni and the ruling National Resistance Movement, or NRM. But in response, Prime Minister Dr. Ruhakana Rugunda says the government in Kampala will have a high-level crisis meeting to come up with what he says will be a common position on the U.S. sanctions against the former police chief. The leader of the opposition parliamentarians, Betty Alo-Chan, tells me her group is displeased with the reaction of the Ugandan government over the U.S. sanctions.
No, not at all. You know, it is us, the opposition, who have been suffering. Kaihura put some other recruited, what squad, and flying squad, and other borders to beat us up. So, this human rights abuse was meted on us. And again, when you go to Nalefanya, it was our people who were suffering. So, for them, even the opposition, even if they die, even if they are killed, it's not a big problem. That's why he said that. Otherwise, you know, human person in his or her right senses can actually condone what Kaihura has been doing.
Some civil society organizations and other opposition parties have welcomed the U.S. sanctions on Kaihura and called on the U.S. government to place more sanctions on people close to the government who have been encouraging such acts, including those in the UPDF or the National Army. Is that the position of Ugandan parliamentarians in opposition?
Well, for us in opposition, that Kaihura is now one person, and the IGP who was so bad on us, let him face it. Then the rest can be handled later. He was in the forefront, whether he was doing his own work or he was doing regime work, that is what we can say. You know, when you implement maybe an order, then you, the implementer, when you commit abuse, human rights abuse, it is the implementer who is seen. And by law, they also say an institution should not be what? Not be blamed. An individual who commits an offense has to actually face it. So it was Kaiura doing all those, whether it was somebody directing him to do it or it was on his own accord, then let him face it.
Prime Minister Rugunda said next week a meeting has been called for the Ministers of Defense, Security, Internal Affairs and Attorney General to examine the matter so that the government could handle the matter from a position of knowledge. Why is the opposition in Parliament not pleased with this answer, since the government would want to react appropriately after examining the sanction against Kaihura?
Opposition have been reacting. Opposition said all what they can say, all of us. Although some other people, because Kaihura comes from their area, then they are on the defensive. Even those in opposition, at least I saw one opposition trying to say it's wrong. There are very many people. It was Kaihura was implementing somebody's command. So if I tell you to kill and you kill, it is you who has killed who should actually face the law, because there is no evidence that I have told you to kill.
What is the expectation of opposition in Parliament about the government response to the U.S. sanctions placed on General Kaihura, the former IGP? What are your expectations?
First expectation and our position, the majority or almost all, I told you that if there are people who are against the sanctions, then there could be very few in the opposition side. But most of us who have actually faced the wrath of Kaihura just say, he is actually now paying the price of what he has been doing. So our position is U.S. is right to put that sanction on him. And for us, for some of us, we say it's not enough yet. They should have even arrested him right now and put him behind bars, because he was ruthless on people.
Betty Aochan is the leader of the Ugandan opposition parliamentarian. She spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. The Coalition of United Political Parties, or CUPP, a major Nigerian opposition group, is expressing concern about an alleged plan to manipulate the Supreme Court. This ahead of the planned appeal by former Vice President Atiku Abubakar over the presidential election petition. The CUPP alleges that the government plans to establish a new 7-member Supreme Court panel favorable to uphold President Muhammadu Buhari's re-election victory challenged by former Vice President Atiku Abubakar. But supporters of the government dismiss the accusations as without merit. To learn more about the opposition party's concerns, I reach Ikenga Imo Ukochinyere, spokesperson for the CUPP.
Whatever the justices say becomes law, and that is why they always select the most experienced, most qualified, and mature minds to be on that panel. And they do it by picking the 7 justices that are the most senior. But the opposition have intercepted a draft list of justices of the Supreme Court that will be announced in violation of the order of superiority. And if that will raise any alarm, you will recall 80% of those alarms were raised turned out to be true. Now, we intercepted a message that shows that Justice Tanko Mohammed will be presiding over the new panel with Justice Rose Vivor, who is the second in command. But suddenly, after Rose Vivor, who is the second in command, they jumped 3 other justices of the Supreme Court, Merio Odelunguta and Ariwola, thereby tinkering with the traditional rule of seniority that have been the order of the day in our Supreme Court since 1979.
You said the opposition party intercepted a draft list of people being considered to be sworn in by the Senate to rule on the appeal of the electoral petition. Now, anybody could have come up with the list
And people are wondering why you are crying wolf of this one. It is not empirical proof.
Why the onus is on the Supreme Court. Like when we released the classified document showing the move to the order to freeze the accounts of the former CJs, three people asked us, how did we get it? Because there are some Nigerians who are in that judiciary who are not happy with the way things are going. And these are sources that were come to trust. And when we intercepted it, all we have done is to bring it to the public domain. The onus is on the Supreme Court of the Republic to tell Nigerians that it's true or false.
Some people are saying that even the list of the most qualified or the most senior justices that you talked about, these are also justices of the Supreme Court. And even if they are selected, what makes you think that they will rule in the government's favor? And to say to it, the former vice president lost at the elections tribunal. So if he loses again, some argue it wouldn't be anything untoward in that, the sense. How do you react to that?
That is why we say he who goes to equity must go with clean hands. First of all, allow the tradition and sanctity and the sacred nature of the procedure of the Supreme Court in arriving at this decision to continue to hold sway. Even though we don't have any past or relationship with the senior justice of the Supreme Court, but if it is done in accordance with the tradition, we will have faith that this thing was done without any magomago. But to jump the tradition and bring in even people that were recruited into the Supreme Court from a few months ago, you will agree with me that we will raise concern and will ask why. How did you arrive at that? Are we going to get justice in such a panel that was handpicked in breach of the tradition of the Supreme Court?
Former Vice President Atiku Abubakar said he remains confident that he will get justice at the Supreme Court upon appeal of the ruling of the election tribunal, saying that nothing good comes easy in Nigeria. Critics of yours are saying the CUPP is just making noise when the appeal has yet to be adjudicated at the Supreme Court. How do you react to that?
Anybody saying that is very unpatriotic. Very, very unpatriotic. Atiku issued a statement as a statesman. Atiku is just one person in the coalition. There is 56 members of that coalition who gave him that coalition candidature. And we have intercepted what is dangerous to the ideas of the coalition. It is our duty to let the public know. This is not a secret business. It is the opposition that is telling you that this is what we have discovered. And I'm asking you, what is crying foul? I have told you, I have produced documents to tell you that few days after denying a secret victory at the appeal court, three of the justices who did that job, you see, believe is a yeoman's job, is about to be elevated. Their name is in the list to Supreme Court. Does that not sound suspicious to you? That is one. Two, we have told you here and now that they have shortlisted and are about to breach the order of seniority. Let the CJN come out and deny that. Have they denied it? The answer is no. And as I speak to you now, the most senior judge of the Federal High Court, who is supposed to be the substantive chief judge of the Federal High Court, another third person has been added strangely to the list, the third in command. The question I will ask you, why? Who is trying to do this? What are they trying to do? Why are you trying to deny Justice Soho his meritorious right? Is it because he's from the minority Christian area of Benue State?
Ikenga Imo Ugo Chinyere is the spokesperson for the Nigerian opposition CUPP. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Members of the Cameroonian Bar Association are scheduled to review the group's recent one-week strike, which ended Friday. The lawyers say the action was necessary since authorities have made it difficult for them to effectively carry out their duties. Organizers hope the strike will help to ensure suspects are treated humanely and that the authorities will stop carrying out torture to extract forceful confessions from accused persons. However, critics say the strike is unlikely to change how suspects are treated. Mi Menkamzova, a prominent member of the Cameroonian Bar Association, tells me that members will decide the next steps forward after they review if the authorities fail to meet the group's demands.
I wouldn't say the objectives of the strikes have been realized in totality. What I can say is that we have pushed the government to know that it is on the wrong stand, because what we are claiming is we don't want any more tortures or violation of the law and human rights. So we are bringing the government to the table of negotiations and the respect of the rule of law through this strike. So negotiations will take over again from next Monday. And if the government finally does not incline itself to the respect of this rule of law, we may go further.
So how soon will lawyers embark on another strike if this one-week strike action to press for protection of human rights of suspects, among other issues raised by lawyers, are not adhered to by the government?
We are striving most for the respect of the rule of law, the respect of the code, and then the respect of human rights. So if the government does not yield to our demands by the following days, it's in two folds. We'll first have to go on negotiations with the government for them to bring us concrete solutions for the respect of human rights and the respect of rule of law. And then the Bar Council shall sit. The Bar Council shall sit a second time to now evaluate the advancement of the implementation of the respect of the rule of law. So within the while, if we still have violations, I think we may gather it up and sum up to another pressure on the government, maybe through a strike or some other thing.
Some people are saying that it appears that members of the Bar Association are supporting separatists and those who are trying to create confusion, tension, and violence, including undermining the territorial integrity of the country, and that the sole constitutional mandate of the government is to protect life and property and maintain the country's territorial integrity, and it will not stop at doing so. What is your response to that?
What we are facing in Cameroon is now that the state is taking the opportunity of protecting the territorial integrity of the territory of Cameroon to torture civilians, to keep them incommunicado and have violations of the basic human rights. We've had situations where even lawyers who went to defend their clients were arrested and equally kept in cells. So this puts a fear in the protection of the basic rights of the civilians. That's why we lawyers are advocating for the respect of human rights. In no way the respect of human rights or the defense of the rights of persons who are sued for terrorism or any other acts would justify the use of torture.
But some of your critics are saying that you are not getting the overwhelming support from human rights lawyers, human rights organizations, and civil society organizations because of some lawyers defend the so-called separatists who want to go their way and thereby create divisions among Cameroonians and to have a separate country.
It's wrong for them not to actually give us the whole support, because the reason for the strike was well elaborated in the announcement or the communique of the Bar president. So not supporting us is as if we had a hidden agenda. There's no hidden agenda. The Bar is advocating for the respect of the rule of law. We have seen this rule of law in Cameroon deteriorated from the past years. This rise in the number of persons being tortured, the rise in incommunicado detention, the rise in the arbitrary arrest and detention of simple individuals and lawyers is one of, in fact, that is the crux of the strike we are holding today. So we are not praying for their support, but it will be interesting and encouraging for human rights and civil societies to support the strike. But we are ahead, and the Bar is advocating for the respect of the rule of law.
Mayor Menkem Sodha is a prominent member of the Cameroonian Bar Association. He spoke with me from the capital, Yaoundé. We'll be right back.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of the Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, an advisor to the Guinean president, Alpha Conde, says a meeting with U.S. Agricultural Department officials will help improve the country's agricultural output. Mohamed Kanyasi says the outcome of the meeting with the U.S. officials will be a significant boost to the presidential initiative to fully mechanize agriculture in Guinea. Kanyasi stopped by the VOA offices here in Washington, D.C. to talk to me about the new presidential initiative, which he says will not only create jobs for the youth, but will also improve agricultural exports for additional foreign exchange.
It was a very interesting and useful meeting because with the Department of Agriculture, we exchanged about our a new agriculture policy. So I can say it was a very, very, very good meeting.
So talking about the new agricultural policy, what is the takeaway, the major takeaway after you held the meeting with the U.S. officials at the Agricultural Department?
Now, today, what we like is to invite most of our partners to have a new view about agriculture in Africa. Mm-hmm. Up to now, we have seen the limit of what we call traditional agriculture. Today we want, let's say when we talk about new agriculture, is availability of mechanization for all. In 2019, it should be something possible, I mean, to attract this young generation to stay, I mean, in agriculture. So we are talking about mechanization, we are talking about good seeds, I mean, what we call perform seeds, mm-hmm. More rentability. We are talking about availability of fertilizers because Africa, we are using very few quantity of a fertilizer. So those type of discussion, why to not go to what we call targets?
Okay. Now, you advise the president, coming from the private sector, you advise President Conde on agriculture. What is the current status of agriculture in Guinea?
No, today in Guinea, what we did the first step to new agriculture, because today in Guinea, mechanization is a reality for all through what we call a digital platform where, I mean, farmers can rent, I mean, tractors. So today we moved, I mean, already to this new agriculture in Guinea.
You know, in most African countries, there's a huge trade imbalance where they import a lot of food. What is the target of Guinea to ensure that Guinea is food sufficient?
Exactly. I mean, this question is more than right. Up to now, most of our country did not have agriculture policy. Africa in general, which is really a mess because with all the possibility we have, as everybody know, we cannot materialize, I mean, these potentials to some advantage. It's, of course, not understandable that today we keep importing. We are poor and we keep importing. It's, of course, emotion is one thing. But today, as I said, we have available solutions to go to realize some targets. So I think for agriculture, there is some necessary action like the mechanization, availability of good seeds, availability of fertilizer. When you look at Africa, we put, let's say, less than 10 kilo per hectare compared to India 200 and other countries in this world 300. All of this action play on production. So we have to look at the problem carefully. We have to accept to structure this agriculture to get more quantity, to not import anymore. Why not to export? Because we have land, we have water, and we have young people ready, I mean, to work on it.
Is there a political will embarking from the president with regards to this agricultural policy that you talked to me about?
Of course. I mean, all of this new agriculture is purely from what we call presidential initiatives.
Okay.
So in Guinea, this was what we call a booster, I mean, to this sector, mm-hmm. which is a support, not only in agriculture, because it's agriculture, it's livestock with artificial insemination, mm-hmm. it's poultry, it's fish farming. So all economic sector from the rural areas of Guinea.
Mohamed Kanyasi is an advisor to Guinean President Alpha Conde. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. And he is an attorney, chief palace advisor to the King of Buganda, and an author. Apollo Makubia has a book which was recently published. It's titled Protection, Patronage or Plunder. Makubia is also the former Deputy Prime Minister of the Kingdom of Buganda. He joins me live here to talk about his latest book. Hello, Apollo, and welcome to Nightline Africa.
Thank you, Peter. I'm very honored to be here.
Wonderful, wonderful. So tell me, what is the motivation behind the title of this book?
The title is very clear. It talks about a question whether, you know, in the colonial enterprise, especially in Uganda and other parts of Africa, the colonial masters were protecting, or because, you know, we had colonies, some were called protectorates. And the idea was that the British colonial masters at the time were protecting the people and the territory. But the question is always, who were they protecting? What were they protecting those people from? Were they actually protecting the people's interests or protecting their own interests? So there's a question mark there. Beyond protection, of course, there's a question of patronage. How did British colonial rule establish itself, install itself in Africa, in Uganda? Was it through conquest? Was it through bribery? Was it through treaty? We want to understand how colonial regime or the colonial state supplanted or replaced traditional institutions with systems that were alien to Africa. So patronage is one of those issues. And the other question is, did it start and stop during the colonial times, or does it continue to this day? Do we see influences of the West, influences of the UK in the policies, in the politics, in the economics of African countries? Or was it outright blunder? Because you can hide behind treaties. You can hide behind diplomacy. You can hide behind all sorts of negotiations. But after 68 years of rule in Uganda, you know, and other parts of the world, time has come for us to question, was it just an enterprise for plundering resources?
But what is, before you go, what is the message of the book here, and what has been the reaction of people who have read the book so far?
The message is really for us to reflect on our history from our viewpoint. The narratives that we've had, both in school and also, you know, in the literature that we read, tends to emphasize the viewpoint of the colonial masters or writers and researchers from the West. Seldom do we get analysis, research, findings by Africans themselves. And this is an effort to change the narrative, to flash those narratives that tend to portray Africa as a place that had zero kind of processes, zero structure, zero values before the West came.
Now, when you meet, you are an influential figure in Uganda, and particularly in the Buganda Kingdom as an advisor to the King of Buganda. Now, when you meet these influential people and some of those who come up with the policies in Uganda, what do you tell them in reference to this book?
I encourage them to read this book because, you know, the reality, you asked me what was the people's response. Many people, including leaders, political and other influential leaders, even traditional leaders, don't really appreciate the impact of colonial rule up to this time. Of course, many say we got independence 55 years ago. Why are we even talking back looking back at colonial rule, and I'm telling them that you need to read to understand how colonialism operates, the methods, the modus operandi, and the impacts, not just during, but after, because colonialism continues even though we get independence in Africa.
Neocolonialism, some people call it.
Yes, some people call it. And until we understand how and why these colonial countries or entities were created, you know, we'll continue to suffer being a continent that is very rich with resources, but whose poor are dying of, whose people are dying of poverty. So it is important, and I encourage them to read up this history. History is not just about things that happened 100 years ago. The question is, when they happened, how did they happen? What was the impact? And how, in contemporary terms, do our circumstances relate to that history? We, you know, we've been talking about democracy in Africa, vis-a-vis, because there's a competition between democracy in the West and democracy in Africa. We are talking about democracy, but when you look at how African states, following the departure of the colonial masters, have practice democracy, you see that there's a distinction, there's a difference.
Talking about that, people have questioned the way Africans are governed. Some are saying the traditional form of governance, where you have the kings, you have kingdoms, you know, where you the authorities have been limited as to what they used to be all these years ago. What did you find as part of your book?
Part of the strategy for Britain to overrun Africa, and Uganda in particular, was to supplant or to remove or to undermine or to weaken traditional institutions and traditional leaders. Those that were resistant were removed, deposed, and deported. Those that were cooperative or collaborative were given certain pseudo-powers. The powers actually remained with the colonial master, who had the guns, who had the money, who had the authority. So your question is, traditional institutions, how were they impacted by colonialism? Invariably, not just in Uganda, but the rest of the continent, these were decimated at the worst, but or deformed, because they didn't continue in the same way that they existed before colonial rule. And because of that, we have now two power centers, because the modern African state is run on a basis of modern governance, electoral democracy, maybe even multi-party democracy, or maybe even military dictatorship, on one hand. And on another hand, a more legitimate form of governance, you know, based on traditional cultural institutions that African people believe in, but which are weak. If I were to explain to you from my part of the world, traditional leaders, especially in Buganda, are respected in many, many ways more than some of the so-called democratically elected leaders. Why? Because the people have trust in them.
Right.
You know, because of the fuss of democracy, some of these elected leaders come to power through a process of bribery, process of corruption, process of coercion, process of violence. You hear all these cases of, you know, vote rigging and so on. So people don't have trust in those leaders. People have trust, more trust in traditional institutions. Yet, traditional institutions, you know, in terms of constitutional frameworks, have no basis, have no money, have no resources, have no legislative power, have no political power to mobilize the public or the population for development or other social causes. So you have a situation where you have people who are respected and trusted without power, and then on the one hand, and then others who have power but are not respected. And that explains part of the crisis we have in Africa, a crisis of governance and leadership.
Well, Apollo, we might have to continue this another time. Apollo Makubia is an author and chief policy advisor to the King of Buganda. He joined me live here in Washington, D.C. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. You're hearing Matupa by Jantal, and then The Money by David Olamide, Sokoto by Magaska, and then Science by King Saha.
Vana hove muri, ko, ana fuhu muri, nimi vana kama. for everyone where they can sing. Now, we don't upgrade the matter. Daily and weekly and monthly and quarter. Now, we don't talk to quarter. Family, this man, we know the quanta. That's what you're so Yoruba. Make them know, forget the Madonna.
Yeah.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, producer Douglas Impuga, and our engineer for today, John Dryden, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, one whose seeds have not sprouted does not give up planting. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
This is VOA News. I'm Steve Cameron.